Thank you, Michael, and good evening. Welcome. I've seen so many familiar faces out here this evening, and that's great. I need all of that great energy out there. What I'd like to do this evening is two pieces. First, a short piece from a novel that I've been working on for a while called Once Upon a Sambo. And the other is also excerpted from a larger work. The first piece is about the valley. You know, the valley so low, make you don't want no more? Some of y'all know what I'm talking about. It's from a novel, again, Once Upon a Sambo. And this particular chapter of the novel I entitled, Who Knocked Up Papa Bear, Stole His Honey Pot, and Left Him Barefoot and Pregnant. Okay? And it's about love, and it's about some of the changes that we go through. Really, it's about the blues, and since we have the Mojo Blues man in the house tonight, Brother Arthur Flowers, I thought I'd do something with a little bit of a blues feel to it. In this particular case, Sam, who is the major character in this first scenario, has what I have to call the low-down blues, what a good friend of mine and poet Shirley LaFleur might call the toe-down blues, and what somebody might call the something's got a hold on me and won't let go blues, okay? It's about being someplace that you don't necessarily want to be, but that's where you be. You may be somewhere else tomorrow, but that's where you be today. And there's nothing that you can do about it except blues it on out. We all been there. And if you haven't been there, I definitely need to see you after this program, because whatever you're using, I want some of it, okay? Okay. As Lou Rawls would say, this particular boy has got it real bad. And that's no good. I better stop that before somebody breaks down boo-hoo crying up in here. Okay, I'm going to do this first piece for you. I need to tell you just a little bit about it. This is Once Upon a Sambo. Sam, in this particular scene, has just returned from Mississippi. He's gone there after a seven-year absence. His wife, his sweetheart, his lover is there. He's gone there to hook back up with her, but it didn't quite go the way he'd planned. So he's stopping over in St. Louis en route to Chicago, and he's seeking out his younger cousin, 16-year-old cousin, Little Buddy, because his blues is coming down, and he needs somebody to tell his troubles to. So that's where this particular scene begins. She's still my best girl, and always will be, little buddy, Sam confessed, head lolling onto his chest like a hungover jack-in-the-box. Only me and the good Lord know what he put on me when he give me SLE. Sometimes when I think about it, I feel like my heart be doing one of them no-hand flips or something. Then sometimes it feel like ain't nothing up inside here but a big old dark empty tomb where life done rose up like a screaming eagle and just flown on off somewhere. He let out hand over his heart like he was about to do the Pledge of Allegiance. But let me tell you something, partner. When they box me up and plant me 6 feet under and all them blind, bottomless earthworms have their way with my heart, they gonna find themselves a sure enough treat. Because the sweetness that little old honey brown girl done give me be spread all through it like a honeycomb. I declare, little buddy, the girl got me wrapped up, tied up, and tangled up so tight, I couldn't break loose even if I was King Kong. She's still my best girl, and always will be. Didn't know how deep it run myself. Not until Jimmy Westland's hip pocket game warden went and threw me in the pokey. When I look back now, I can see with the clear eye that that was when things between me and SLE went from plain bad to ugly. Before that, even if the gates of hell itself had swung against me, it wouldn't have cut no mustard with Essie Lee. The girl believed in me more than I believed in myself. Didn't look like she needed no reason. I mean, she would have believed I could walk water or dance buck naked on coals of fire without getting burned if I'd told her so. What else can I tell you? The girl loved herself some Sambo, dirty drawers and all. But laying there on that nasty jailhouse floor, feeling come over me that something, I didn't know what, was about to slip away from me that I wasn't never going to be able to get back no more. That's how come I say them was the darkest 7 days of my life, because that's when I felt Essie Lee's love light go out. You see, little buddy, it wasn't until I'd left out of the jailhouse that I found out that love got more sides to it than you think. Just because you can't see them all at once don't mean they ain't there. Here's what I'm getting at. Folk think just because me and Essie Lee ain't never been able to hold things together for long, because we've been separated from one another for the last 6 or 7 years, that love done up and growed itself a mojo hand, done broke down with the hoodoo hustle and poof, disappeared into thin air. All because they can't see the broad side of it nowhere. No, partner. That ain't the way it works. When old man Westland sprung me from the caboose, wasn't but one thought on my mind, getting back to Essie Lee. It was like I'd clean forgot about Professor Straw's old musty 20-gauge shotgun that he almost kissed me with the last time I showed my face at his door. So the first thing I set about doing after I bear-hugged my mama and thanked everybody for the prayers I know they'd been sending up for me was to start getting myself together for a wedding party. Yeah, a wedding party. My mind was set tight in a bear trap, little buddy. Couldn't see nothing but me and Essie Lee and little Sam Jr., because I knowed she was pregnant with a baby boy. Hadn't been thinking about nothing else for the last 2 or 3 months, except maybe figuring out ways to dodge them lawmen. Whether I'd be netting fish or gigging them, hustling puckhorns or hunting rabbits, all at once a thought would leap on my back like a witch was riding me, and I couldn't move. So I just lean over on my gig or my shotgun or prop myself up against whatever kind of tree happened to be handy, because I'd be looking at all three of us together, me, Essie Lee, and little Sam, happy as honey bears, living in our own little house with red shingles on the roof, romping around in our own front yard planted with magnolia trees and all kind of pretty flowers. Another thing was that the walkway would be lined with white bricks leading up to the gate, and there was a whitewashed fence running clean round the yard. Man, it was just like I was at the picture show. I could see it so clear. Then sometimes I'd change up the colors of the flowers and the shingles on the roof and even the shape of the house just for fun. Then I'd plant me some peach or fig or persimmon or puckhorn trees in the backyard, all depending on what I had a taste for at the time. But the part that didn't ever change was me and Essie Lee and little Sam Jr. stomping all over the place, happy as honey bears. That's what I think I was thinking about for all them weeks after I got put out of the cotton fields, all the time I was out there in them woods hustling, or even when I was gardening, trying to scratch an extra dollar or two out of the dirt around my mama's house. Aside from buying a few treats for mama, my mind was mostly set on buying my freedom papers from Jimmy Westland. Yet and still, part of every piece of money I made went into a mason jar I kept buried in the corner of my garden. What could I do for Essie Lee and little Sam without some kind of stake? That money was going to be the down payment on our honey bear dreams. Little buddy, it took me all of 3 days after I come out of the jailhouse to get myself back together. Because by the time them good old boys let me loose, I felt like one of them Omega flour sacks, been emptied out, scrubbed down, turned inside out, and hung out to dry. Maybe it had something to do with all them blackjacks or that blue steel they went upside my head with. But afterwards, looked like I could see into things and even round corners. Don't ask me to explain it no better, because I can't. Anyhow, it gave me a different idea about me and Essie Lee and the baby being able to make it somehow. Not because anything had changed on the outside. I mean, Mr. Weston was still dangling the keys to my cage. And the buckshot in old man's straw shotgun could still make you come up missing a tail feather or two. But because for the first time in my life, I found out that things had an inside as well as an outside. After all, I was a living witness. The very fact that I was still walking and breathing told me that there was life on the flip side of death, and with a bigger paycheck to boot. And since everybody seemed so dead set against me and SLE being together, I figured that that had to have a flip side too. Now, I'm sure I don't have to tell you that that was the only way side I was figuring on seeing. Man, I was a honey bear from the word go after I peeped the other side of death for the first time. What else was there to stop me? So when Mama saw me throwing my rags together, I mean like she had never seen me putting them together before, she knowed exactly what was on my mind, especially after she sat and watched me bust open my mason jar and count my booty down to the penny. She tipped around me on cat feet for 2 days before she finally got up nerve enough to tell me about how Essie Lee had fell low sick and lost a baby boy, the same night them lawmen took me off. On top of that, she told me that Essie Lee had sent a message by her cousin Roseanne the day before I got out of jail, begging me please not to try and come and see her because her daddy and brothers was in a mean mood, and she didn't want no harm to come to me or them. Little buddy, ain't no way for me to explain to you how I felt. Because even if I had 1,000 voices right now, I still couldn't tell it. It would have been better if somebody had held me down and made me swallow a bucket of red devil lye, or skinned and gutted me open like a billy goat. Man, I'm telling you, I wanted to go to the cross and be crucified. I wanted to feel them blood-sucking thorns biting into my skull like blades of lightning. Wanted to feel the nails splitting my hands and my foots open like kindling wood. Then maybe, just maybe, that would have been enough to keep me from feeling what I was feeling for Essie Lee and my poor little baby boy, little buddy. I couldn't have felt no worse for little Sam Jr. than if somebody had dragged Mama off to the chopping block and butchered her like a Jersey cow. Anyway, that's what I'm trying to tell you about love and all them different sides that's got to it. I wasn't nothing but a rusty butt boy when I first got together with Essie Lee. I mean, I know she was different from the start because I never knowed a woman or a girl to fill me up that way. Didn't even know I could feel that much for any woman who wasn't no kin to me. Really didn't make no sense to me at the time, but sense didn't have nothing to do with it. The girl filled up places and spaces in me that I didn't even know I had. If I had been one of them balloons like you see at the circus, shaped like a teddy bear or a monkey or a clown, it would have been like I was blowed up halfway, say from my foots up to my belly button, because the rest of me was flabby as a flapjack. Well, it was like Essie Lee blowed breath into me, rounded me out, and growed me up. I felt whole for the first time in my life, little buddy. Come to think of it, it was a lot like getting religion, because the girl sure made me feel brand new. And then when she went and got pregnant, I got pregnant too, because I was carrying both her and Sam Jr. inside of me. And man, they was growing by the day, filling out my chest and my arms and growing me up taller. Every time I'd go into them woods to scratch out a sack of puckhorns or haul in a net full of flapping fish or bag me a mess of quails, my arms bulged out a little bigger, stretched a little wider. My heart got stronger. My head set more level on my neck. My eyes got clearer. Man, sometimes both of them skins would get to kicking and tussling around inside me. It hurt so bad till I had to stretch way beyond myself. You see, all of them kind of things is what love will do for you. And if it don't, well, it ain't much count no how. Anyway, when Mama told me what she told me about Essie Lee and all that bruised blood and tissue that had been Essie Lee and little Sam and my own bigger, growed-up self come tumbling down out of me, somehow I made it to my bed and I laid there for a day and a night. Didn't have the strength or will to move. Laid there hoping it was the grave, hoping somebody would be decent enough to kick 6 feet of dirt on me. But that wasn't in the plan. So the next morning I woke up with just one thought left in my head. To get to Essie Lee any which way I could. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to do another piece for you. Thank you very much. I feel the warmth. I feel the energy. Yeah. The second piece I want to do for you this evening is, by contrast, is about turning that blues groove on the flip side. It's about being in the valley because that's where you came in, but looking up to the hills and the mountaintops beyond. It's taken from a novella entitled The Maestro, and it's dedicated to my very good friend and Bashan High School classmate, Donnie Hathaway. Some of you have probably heard of him. Donnie was a powerful musician, sang with Roberta Flack a number of popular hits. But a real artist, real genius in his soul, and I'd always wanted to do something for him. We lived two houses from each other during our years in high school, and so we walked to school together every day. I got to know him very well. So I'd wanted to do something a long time ago, but the form just came recently, and I decided to use creatively, you know, my experience with him. And this story takes place right here in the city of St. Louis, on a street smack dab in the heart of the hood. Could be South Central LA, could be Detroit, Chicago, Memphis, or any of the ghettos across America. And it's about keeping your head to the sky. It's about soaking up some beauty wherever you be and passing it along. You see, me and the maestro first hooked up way back in high school. Funny thing is, I forgot all about how tough we used to hang out together. In fact, most of what I'm going to tell you about him probably never would have seen the light of memory if it hadn't been for that bomb of a wake-up call one Sunday afternoon in the dead of winter. It was cold as a witch's nose outside, and I was all balled up under a brick-red comforter on the love seat. I ain't shucking you home. I was deep in the mix, chilling to the bone, listening to Phoebe Snow strumming her guitar and crooning Inspired Insanity as I sank down, down, down into the wild, sweet ambrosia misting inside my head. I just raised up to set the repeat lever on the stereo and was about to curl up with Phoebe for the third time running when the phone rang and the husky tombstone blue voice on the other end told me that the maestro had just sky-scattered clean off the planet. But before I go off on a riff, let me take it back to the bridge, because if it hadn't been for the music, me and the maestro might have never hooked up in the first place. I'd sang in church since I was knee-high, so naturally the first elective I put down when I got to high school was concert choir. Well, the deal was that you had to prove that your chops were lean and mean first, and the proving ground turned out to be junior choir. And wouldn't you know it, I'm all revved up to peep some fat, booty-bamming, body-slamming honeys, but the first thing I see when I fall in the door is this roly-poly dude sitting in front of a Baldwin Grand dominating the view. I mean, he was just squatting there like a giant hog maw, blocking. That being the case, I couldn't help but check out his rags, especially that old-timey-looking gray suit coat with the split riding piggyback up his rump. On top of that, he was wearing a blue plaid flannel shirt with a pair of faded green gabardine trousers and button-down suspenders. And if that wasn't enough to pigeonhole him as a fugitive from my granddaddy's generation, he had on a pair of Army Surplus Store shoes, spit shine, no less. Needless to say, I was offended. After all, this was Vashon High, 1963, St. Louis, Louis Moe, the Ket Daddy capital of the Midwest. And somebody needed to hip this dude. I knew right then he couldn't play beans for me, let alone a Baldwin Grand. That's when I remember seeing him around the hood. In fact, I'd peeped him marching past my house a few times, double clutching that cheesy vinyl briefcase under his arm as me and my boys set out on the front shooting the breeze. But he'd always keep his eyes angled to the side, away from us, or gazing down at the toes of his shoes. And the whole while he'd be stepping in double quick time, like he was on a mission.
the tail of that gray suit coat slapping his haunches like high-yo silver. Sometimes he'd draw out a snicker or two from amongst the transient knot of jokesters and tail spinners and would-be players that hung out in our yard. But except for a crinkle in his jaw and a little embarrassed loll of his head, you'd never suspect that he'd seen us at all. And if it hadn't been, I hadn't been on the verge of going to high school, because that was the summer before, I might have stooped to a few hoots myself. I mean, the way he'd be dressed up in them country cornflake-looking duds tempted you to want to do something like that. Anyway, back to choir practice. I couldn't imagine that a dude that unhip would even know how to find middle C on a classy instrument like that. But there he was, bigger than life, and I mean that literally. The usual rigmarole went on with Miss Blue, the choir director doing her spiel and grouping everybody according to voices. Then about 10 minutes before the period was up, with a little nudging from a raunchy group of junior choir lifers in the back, she decided to turn us loose on a song just to get our pipes warmed up. That's when she turned to the maestro, who'd been sitting as unobtrusively as possible at the pianoforte, as she called it, and introduced him as her student apprentice for the semester. Then he stood up, wearing that little shame-faced grin, his head lolling a little bit to the side as a few scattered snickers rippled through the room, and somebody called out, "Fat boy!" Miss Blue, hands hugging her hips, cut a dagger stare at the heckler, then went on to direct Fat Boy to play the piece through so that we'd all know where to go. He fumbled in his briefcase for a good minute, then came up with a crumpled piece of sheet music, trying to press out the wrinkles with his hands as he stood it up before him. Meanwhile, Miss Blue stood arms folded, right foot tapping, attitude rising fast. "Well, are you going to play it or just stand there looking dumb?" she snapped. His head did a quick eyes right as laughter pealed over the room in five-part harmony. Then, glancing offhandedly at the sheet music, his Vaseline smooth fingers struck the first chord. I don't even remember the name of the song. No doubt an old standard, but the main thing I do remember about that day was that this hunky-dory-looking dude was never the same afterwards. Not for me, not for anyone in the room with their ears pinned on straight. The thing that blew everybody away was the finale, a sneaky staccato attack upon the unsuspecting pianoforte, followed by a virtuoso display of nimble fingerwork as he ran the full breadth of the piano several times, then dovetailed into a cool, crystal light arpeggio that made it sing like a harp. It was at that point that one of the baritone lifers, Oscar Higginbotham, roared from the back of the room, "Get down, maestro!" And the name stuck, like everything that belongs to you. I remember a good while after that, after the maestro had gained a good bit of notoriety in gospel circles around St. Louis, that he popped in on our choir rehearsal. Although we attended different churches, we visited each other occasionally. But this was a first, and as he strolled casually down the aisle that Tuesday night, the song we were rehearsing was all but drowned out in the curiosity and expectancy among the choir members. At first, our minister of music, a woman in her early 30s with a not unimpressive string of musical honors to her credit, didn't know what to make of this sudden case of mass laryngitis. Then, noticing our jubilant expression, she turned to see the maestro seated unobtrusively in the third row pew in back of us. "Oh," she let out, covering her mouth with one hand like she'd just been caught moonlighting in a honky-tonk joint. All at once, she started to get up from her stool as if the maestro's mere presence was her cue to give up the piano. Then, catching herself, she plopped back down. Meanwhile, the maestro's face registered obvious embarrassment as the telling gesture was surely not missed by the choir. "You see, I live right down the street," he began a hasty explanation, hat in hand, his back slightly bent in that old-fashioned deference that his grandmama had drilled into him. "And I just happened to be passing by and heard the music, so I thought it might be okay if I just sit and listen for a while." "You have a very fine choir," he ejaculated nervously. "Oh, no, I mean you. By all means, we're delighted to have you," she said, as she gestured to us as we crowded around the piano. But why should we waste time listening to ourselves when we have such a celebrity in our midst? You must play something for us, anything. Or better still, teach us one of those wonderful new arrangements that you are always coming up with. Our young people admire you so. She beamed ecstatically. On cue, everybody chimed in to form an enthusiastic chorus. Yeah, why don't you jam something, maestro? That'd be super hip. Y'all heard the motion. Can I get a witness? The last remark was answered by a thunderous amen and a shout of applause. The maestro sighed as he made his way out of the pew toward us, waving his arms in protest. Now, wait a minute. I didn't come here to disrupt your rehearsal. I really came to hear y'all sing. So I tell you what, I'll do one short number for you if you'll let me just sit and listen for the rest of the rehearsal. Fair enough? Bet. You ain't said nothing but a word. That sounds slick. The minister of music slid down from her perch like an excited schoolgirl, and the maestro seated himself on the bench. He fiddled around on the keyboard for a few seconds, then repositioned the bench first closer, then farther away. The room fell silent as he sat with his hands poised on both sides of the bench as he searched his head for a tune. "Do peace be still," Marlene, a skinny nut-brown alto, broke into his reverie. "Yeah, we got your back," Wendell seconded the motion in a deep baritone. The maestro smiled his acknowledgement as he struck the keyboard. Although everyone knew the song well, none of us could be sure just what the maestro was playing. That was because he had a way of elaborating or improvising upon a melody that was like Sunday afternoon picnic in the park fresh, you know? I mean, it was unorthodox, funky, and sometimes downright zany, just like the maestro himself. It was like all the ditties and dirges, ballads and blues you knew, slipping and sliding, ambling and scrambling up and down the keyboard like a gang of dusty butt children. Right smack in the middle of a stomp-down, hope-to-die gospel classic, you might hear snatches of the theme from, say, The Andy Griffith Show. Or Peter Gunn. Or 77 Sunset Strip. Boom, bang. Sometimes it would be the jingle from a popular television commercial like the one with Bucky Beaver belting out, "You'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent." Or a nursery rhyme, or even a phrase or two of Beethoven, Rachmaninoff, or Schubert waltz. There were times when he'd take one of those good old Thomas A. Dorsey standards like Precious Lord, rip it open at the seams, and take us on a soul train excursion into the deep core underground of rhythm and blues, marching us through medleys of Gene Chandler's Duke of Earl, Duke of Earl. Or the tempting temptation, "The way you do the things you do." Or Marvelous Marvin, "Can I get a witness?" Then he just might tie a ribbon around it with Billie Holiday's "God Bless the Child," leaving Jimmy Reed's slow dragging harmonica to bring up the rear with, "You got me running. You got me hiding. You got me run, hide, run, run." You know the story. Sometimes he'd hammer out the melody so tough till it would fritter as thin as gold filigree, until we didn't know if we were coming or going. It was sort of like we were all prodigals who somehow wandered off into a faraway country. So until we didn't even know, we were lost until we'd hear the familiar sound of the maestro's fingers deep stroking the soft underbelly of the hymn as he, wailing like Mahalia, let us know that our road-weary souls had stumbled upon home ground again. When I look back now on all those rainbow-bright excursions, they remind me of something Dr. Martin Luther King said once about all of us being caught up in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment. Because that was exactly what the maestro was doing on the piano as he pumped away like a black Rumpelstiltskin, warping and woofing all those splintered snatches of melody together on his magical loom like Ghanaian kente cloth, weaving golden harmonies from the most humble straw. It was that gold-threaded harmony that welled up and gushed out of us like a summer storm that evening as we fell in around him. I believe the maestro surprised even himself that night because I'd never really heard him sing like that before. And it was because of that experience that I began to recognize the power he held inside that considerable edifice of his. So as we strolled leisurely down the church steps after rehearsal, still feeling the glow. Two choir members, Wendell, the baritone, and Howard, a first tenor, hung on to us. It was pretty obvious that they were reluctant to take leave of the maestro whom they'd evidently regarded as the source of their peculiar intoxication. It was one of those hot summer nights in the hood with the raucous hubbub of voices hailing from all directions at once. There was music everywhere, blaring from handheld transistors along the stroll, spilling from cruising cars, as well as the sonic boom of bass from No Money Down hi-fi sets shaking the thin walls of the crowded flats along the street. The winos were out in force, directing traffic and selling buku wolf tickets, while the street players in groups of twos and threes, dressed to kill, were strolling up and down like extras on a Hollywood movie set. Then ever so often you could spy a lone, gangster-lean cat daddy, his Knox Jaguar Ace Deuce, half-moon banisters bleeding light as he diddy-bopped for life and limb, one hand cocked inside his lapel in self-defense against the evil night. Meanwhile, front steps and stoops were overflowing with hot, heavily corseted bodies that would be free if only. In retaliation, their belly-bottom sighs careened into sharp-edged laughter that sliced the air like switchblades, their whistling, menagerie-like voices taking flight on the warm, rising tufts of air to trouble the nappy heads of an occasional oak or elm tree. And smack dab in the middle of all this jam-packed life, translucent beams of moonlight rode the air like a heavenly host, belying any insinuation of the crouching ugly lurking like booger bears in alleys and gangways and back pockets stuffed with half-empty pints of Sweet Rosie O'Grady, white port, wild turkey, and old crow. The magic was in the mix and ran rift through the streets like a butt-naked streaker. And hovering above it all, as tender and black as my grandmama's face, was the stillness of the distant sky lit up with a zillion stars that winked and went googly-eyed at each other as they twinkled their blessings down upon us. It must have been stardust that tickled the maestro's ear that night as we strolled down the steps of the church and onto the street. Hanging on to the hand railing, he snapped his fingers and stopped stone still as he reached the bottom. All of us stopped and turned round, thinking maybe he left something inside. But instead of heading back up the steps, he stood there gazing at us with this silly grin on his face. A moment later, he stepped onto the sidewalk and wandered past us like he was tipsy, not stopping until he reached the curb. "You fellas feel like making a little music?" He turned suddenly and gazed at us, his eyes twinkling under the street lamp. "I just heard something I'd like to try out on you." The three of us sang our agreement in unison as if the maestro had just voiced our secret hope. We were all caught up in the magic of that hot and bothered summer night, and we just weren't ready to let it go. Meanwhile, the maestro strolled off a little farther around the corner, away from the streetlight. Naturally, we took the hint and fell in step behind him. But a second later, I checked my stride. Maybe it was his gait, or the funny way he was holding his head off to the side and grinning, like some Georgia Brown honey was whispering sweet something-somethings in his ear. Or maybe it was the way his whole face was lit up with a soft glow that I mistook at the time for moonlight. Then all of a sudden he stopped, again, right at the edge of the curb. Only this time he leaned his rotund frame into the night like he was holding a glass to a wall. I stopped dead still when I peeped what was going down, causing a pileup of the other fellows at my heel. Then with another snap of his fingers, the maestro turned on us, eyes sparkling. "I got it," he exclaimed with a vehemence that surprised us as he swung away from the curb and almost ran back to our ragged little circle. "Okay, you first," he grasped Wendell by the arm and yanked him into the center of the circle. "Okay, I want you to sing this." Then using his long, slender fingers as a baton, he charted the baritone part against the night air. After going over it a couple of times, he moved on to the first tenor and repeated the same procedure. Then standing a little way back from the circle, he directed them together, hardly able to contain his elation. Yeah, that's it," he exclaimed, letting loose that raunchy laugh of his as the voices twined about each other in the stillness of the space that seemed to surround us like a bubble. Now he turned swiftly to me, his eyes wild. Okay, here it is," he said, gazing intently off into space as his fingers seized my shoulder. There was silence as his face suddenly quivered with irritation. Wait a minute, he commanded as he let go of me and marched in double quick time back to the curb like he dropped something. Except he looked up instead of down as he cupped his hand about his ear and leaned in against the wall of the night. I got it, he shouted as he whirled round and trotted back to us. Okay, you sing this, he ordered, clutching my arm in a vice grip. Needless to say, I was starting to get a little uneasy. Then I remember seeing him do finger exercises with a hard rubber ball and rationalize that he was simply not aware of his own strength. Still looking in his eyes as he spoke to me, I wasn't even sure he knew my name. He proceeded to hum the second tenor part, which struck me as a weird, off-color kind of sound. So when my turn came to sing the part, I hesitate, not wanting to spoil my rep. What's the matter? Is it too high for you? He asked, puzzled. Well, no, I quibbled under his gaze. Then let's hear it, he let out, looking relieved. It don't sound right, maestro. It sound kind of off to me. Are you sure? Off, he whispered to himself, mouth gaping open, eyes surveying the night like he didn't know the meaning of the word. What do you mean by off? He shot at me, his face so tangled up until it looked like he was in pain. Then his eyes were bearing down on me like high beams, the voice strafing me all over with goosebumps as he spat out the words. Off? Man, that's what I hear. Now sing your part. The mere force of his command settled all my doubts, and I lunged into the part with a gusto that surprised even me. Now all three voices together, I heard the maestro say as he stepped away from us, except this time he didn't breathe a word as the magic of the merger swathed us all in gold. Meanwhile, we stood there grinning at each other, fingertips gliding over palms in an exchange of cool, moist high fives. But the maestro just stood there with his eyes closed, silently playing the air. I remember feeling my own eyelids edge out the world as the music swept me up into a swoon. When I opened them a moment later, I saw a puddle of liquid moonbeam streaking slowly down the maestro's cheeks. Okay, let's take it on home this time, y'all, he said gently as he stepped forward to complete the circle. Then he bent his own voice into ours in a smooth, soul-searing falsetto as the fat-fingered harmony closed in around us like a healing hand. And for one chock-full moment of eternity, it was as if we were one heart, valves thumping and pumping melody into harmony to birth a newborn sound that none of us, except perhaps for the maestro, had ever heard before. And yet there were moments when the rapture careened wantonly, drunkenly, on the raw-boned rib of rupture. Its quadruple tones stretched taut and jagged into a strident dissonance. It was like each of our voices was being pitted in a never-say-die tug-of-war against the other, until the melody seemed about to split open like a pomegranate. Then, in the very instant before breakup, the maestro's sweet back falsetto cuckooed and cajoled us, lured us home to harmony like a siren song, admonishing us that love, after all, was a many-splintered thing. Then we were one heart again, only purified, folksified, stronger for our hellish, lovelorn journeys as we lifted our faces to the sky in wonder and gratitude, voices mating like sparrows in the still air as we crooned.
That's your part.
I got my You got your part?
I'm ready.
Let's take it on home.
Over my head, I hear music in the air. Over my head, I hear music in the
We're going to have to do this again. Wait a minute. You ready to take it on home?
You ready to take it on home, brother man?
You ready to take it on home?
Let's do it.
We can do it, all right? We got it this time?
You got it this time?
All right. You got your note, right?
You got it?
Okay, all
right.
All right.
Over my head, I hear music in the air. Over my head, I hear music in the Baba do up, there must be a God somewhere. Baba do up, there must be a God somewhere
over my head. I can hear music over my head. I can hear singing. There must be a God somewhere.
Up above my head, I hear singing, boys. Let's get busy.
Up above my head, I hear music.
Up above my head, I hear music.
Up above my head, I hear music.
There must be
Thank you. Thank you very much for me and for those great young folks backing me up here. I want to introduce them and recognize them because they've worked very hard to, on very short notice, to do this tune. It's from all from U City High. Right. The U City community is out in force tonight. First, the maestro, Mr. Van Banks, administrator at University City High. Could all of each of you stand as I call your name? Okay. Mr. Van Banks, Andre Milton, Richard Simmons, Aaron Friesen, Jermaine Robinson, and Naima and Akili Wartz. Thank you, thank you. You've been a wonderful, wonderful audience, and I bid you good evening. And to stay around for Brother Arthur Flowers. He's the Mojo Blues man, and he's well, well worth hearing. Thank you again.